The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
All right, ladies, shall we?
You just arriving?
Or are you just leaving?
There are some nights in the tiny town of Nelson, New Hampshire, when the only obvious signs of life come from its white clapboard town hall. You make your way from the lobby and de facto mudroom into the main hall, where a band of musicians play traditional folk tunes as dancers make their way into rows, couples facing each other or positioned into groups of four. Some are in soft-soled shoes. Some go barefoot to protect the old floor. Then up to the stage steps what's known as a caller, a guide, really, who shouts out dance moves in time with the music and teaches steps to the newbies.
Now circle to the left. Fall into the same waves. Balance. Walk on to the next and balance.
This is a contra dance. Couples swirling and do-si-doing in circles and lines and groups, clapping and kicking up their legs and stomping. It's a folk dance form brought here by the earliest settlers. Even the austere Puritans did it. It's all in style, made contra well suited for a fledgling democracy. Word in today's circuit is that it's possible to attend a contra dance somewhere in New Hampshire every Friday, Saturday, and Monday night for a month without hitting the same floor twice. If you're a born and raised Granite Stater who's never attended a contra dance, you're not alone. Despite being a long-lived tradition in New England, the popularity of contra has ebbed and flowed over the years. Yet it's been kept alive through generations of fiddlers and callers. The beckoning glow of a town hall on a cold January night, and a touch of strong-arming from an industrial magnate. Today on Word of Mouth, New Hampshire's contra dance scene, how it's endured since the days of the early settlers, and how it's changed to reflect the times. We begin where many in the state have, with Dudley Loffman.
The combination, it was in this whole living room. There was a fireplace. There'd always be a fire in the fireplace. And the smell of the wood smoke and the rosiny sound of Jonathan's fiddle and the firelight gleaming on the girl's hair. I was hooked.
Dudley Loffman was a kid working at a New Hampshire dairy farm when he first encountered the New England junket. These were dinner and dancing parties traditionally thrown after a barn raising or maybe a maple sap boiling. In Dudley's case, the lady of the house had read about contra in a dance manual written by Henry Ford. And I promise we're going to come back to that story later. Well, the farmer's wife invited in neighbors and friends and called out moves from the book while her husband played. A few years later, while studying at agriculture school in Walpole, Massachusetts, Dudley met Ralph Page.
Ralph was a dancing master from Keene.
He's a legend in
He was my mentor.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. We never talked about that. So I'd go to his dances, and that's how I learned, by just listening to him.
Dudley says he tried his hand at hockey while in school, but was always drawn back to contra.
Some of the boys had been trained to call by the Ashmans, and I noticed that they, those boys, got a lot of attention from the female segment of the audience, in other words, groupies, and I thought that's pretty neat. So I sort of stashed that away. Well, the next year, it was an open winter. We didn't have any ice. Plus, there was an injury, so we didn't have a hockey team, and I dredged up that memory of groupies.
I'm seeing a pattern here. This is a contra dance, being a caller, being in the band, great way to pick up women.
Yeah.
It wasn't long before Dudley Loffman decided that dairy farming was not going to work out for him.
Well, when did you realize you could make a living, though, as a caller?
Barely.
Yeah.
Oh, I think I discovered that when I stopped working on the dairy farm and I got interested in Back to the Land, mm-hmm. early 50s on, and I got some land in Canterbury for $25. And then I got some lumber for $900 and built a little shack and thought, you know, that's all I have to do. It's not the way it turned out, but that's figured all I had to do.
Though Dudley didn't make as much as a musician and caller, he'd hit on a right place and right time moment for this kind of folk tradition in the U.S. Within a couple of years, he'd formed the Canterbury Country Dance Orchestra. That band played the Newport Folk Festival in 1965, the very year and very stage where Bob Dylan went electric, leaving folk fans feeling betrayed. Still, the folk revival continued, as did the Back to the Land movement, and both fueled Dudley's career. Back to the Landers have waxed and waned over the course of history, but the movement gained steam after World War II, when the desire for a purposeful and self-sufficient life led to an exodus of young urbanites into rural New England. Contra dance attracted these same homesteaders.
All the Back to the Landers just flocked to that. You know, they were ready for it. So they began to come to the dances and draws and gradually began to outnumber the old-timers that had been dancing. And so then I had to start either teaching more of the dances or doing something different. And I discovered what I call the barn dance.
Dudley wanted to find a way in for the new hippie influx and began calling simpler dances that didn't require teaching or prior knowledge. He brought this pared-down style to New Hampshire dance halls and dances, which soon adopted his methods and his name.
And I started doing them, so they became known as Dudley dances. But prior to that, I was doing the old traditional dances to a crowd that knew them, but who were gradually being outnumbered by this swarm of hippies coming in. That put me in bad odor with the contra dance crowd, but I was still getting large numbers of people come into my dances.
Today, Dudley says, Dudley dance means something a little different.
It just means easier dances that aren't very interesting for a lot of people who want the more complicated dances. That's okay with me. If they don't want to come to my dance, fine. There's plenty of others.
There are plenty of others, and that's the change that's occurred in contra over the past few decades. Just as Dudley shook things up with a form tailored to young newcomers, today's contra dance scene has once again adapted to suit a new generation.
Well, it's become more urban than rural. And it's also become influenced by the computer programmers. One thing is computer programmers don't like any downtime. And so they're composing contra dances that have no downtime. In other words, everybody's doing something all the time. So that's okay. I'm just not interested in that. But that's one of the changes. It's a major one. And a lot of young people are getting into doing this because it's easy business to get into.
Just short of calling them newfangled dances the kids do these days, Dudley says that the updated dances have a continual flow to them, reeling dancers from one move to the next. And what they're missing is time for people to get to know one another.
Well, first of all, the dancing is a form of courtship. It moves so fast these days that a lot of people miss that.
Well, courtship seemed to move pretty fast these days, too.
Yeah, I know, but I think, you know what I mean. In order to be involved with a courting, you have to flirt. And the dance moves so fast you pass from one partner to the next before you have a chance to even blink your eye, you're on to the next one. And that's, to me, that's not the way I want to do it.
For Dudley, there's a magic to the contra music that he grew up on. It is the alchemy of allowing interaction, lingering, the hand held for a second too long, and the rise and fall of the notes. As that changes, new generation contra is drifting away from the music that literally moved Dudley and others in their contra heyday. There's a sense of loss at those disintegrating customs and traditions, not unlike the ache of modernism that Thomas Hardy wrote about during the Industrial Revolution.
And the other thing is that the music is also emotional. And, well, Thomas Hardy, the English writer, novelist.
One of my faves.
He used to play the button accordion, and his father played the fiddle. His grandfather played the fiddle, and an uncle played the saxophone, what was then called the sack butt. And they had a family band and played for dances. And Thomas Hardy, at 4 years old, played the melodeon, which is what I was playing, the accordion. And they had one tune called Enrico. And it moved Thomas Hardy so much that it would move him to tears. And he'd have to leave the room because he was embarrassed. And that some of these tunes, they do it.
Have you been moved to tears?
You bet.
When Dudley was cultivating the contradance scene, he says there was what he called a real physical community. You attended a dance in the town where you lived. These days, though,
what we have is the greater community of the dance, so that people who, for instance, go to the dance in East Concord or in Gilmanton or whatever, do not all live in East Concord or Gilmanton. In fact, very few of them do. It's all right. It's not my choice, but that's okay. And the difference between that kind of community and a real physical community, the people who go to these contra dances these days expect the dance to be more of what I call a modern urban contra dance.
And for him, the music is just too precise. While the notes may be perfect, he feels they lack soul.
They play it by the book, and I'd sooner go to a dogfight than dance to that.
So would you say you're a purist?
Well, some people think I am. I don't think I am, but...
Dudley Laufman. He's been playing fiddle and accordion and calling for most of his life. He's now 86. He's also a poet and part-timer at a dairy farm. When Word of Mouth returns, what contradance looks like in New Hampshire today, the young musicians who are making it their own, and those, young and old, who are keeping it alive and swinging.
Well done. Thank you, partners. Thank you.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. The mention of contradance may conjure, for some, an image of folksy wholesomeness, a simple, distinctly American pastime with age-old roots, and one that has survived despite social and technological shifts. Contradancing, which means opposite dancing in French, traveled here with early American settlers, mixing the restrained gentility of the English with Scots-Irish raucousness. These dances stayed popular through celebrations of the American independence and the end of the Civil War, but waned at the end of the 19th century. In 1976, New Hampshire author Richard Neville and filmmaker Robert Fiore documented the peaks and valleys of the movement in a PBS special. They found a pastime that endured in America's rural corners.
And they'd dance until about midnight. And then at midnight, they'd put on a baked bean supper or an oyster supper. And all people would bring pies and donuts and things like that, and they'd have a regular feed. And then after the supper, they'd clear off the table and go to dancing again. And sometimes it'd even get long toward time for someone to do chores and be on Saturday night, and they'd go home, do the chores, and come back, and they might well be dancing through Sunday forenoon.
Meanwhile, the population, power dynamics, and traditions of the nation were evolving wildly. With the explosion of the jazz age, popular dancing became close and fast, the music unpredictable. It was described as jungle music, and people feared its spread. Still, contradance survived in small hamlets and farmers' kitchens and barns while the rest of the world moved on. But in the mid-20s, suddenly it was back and got really popular, and that was by design. Producer Hannah McCarthy looked a little closer into this unsinkable tradition and joins us with more. Hello, Hannah.
Hi there, Virginia.
So what did you learn about contradance in the Roaring Twenties?
Well, You spoke with two of New Hampshire's resident contradance authorities, that's Dudley Loffman and Richard Neville, who made that documentary, and both credited Henry Ford as this sort of life raft of contradance in the U.S.
Yeah, that's right. Dudley said his first contra experience was after a dairy farmer's wife read about it in a book by Henry Ford.
Yeah, and that book was called Good Morning, After a Sleep of 25 Years, Old-Fashioned Dancing is Being Revived by Mr. and Mrs. Henry Ford.
Besides being a little bit of a mouthful, that's a little grandiose.
So it definitely sounds that way, but the thing is that Henry Ford was massively influential in the country way beyond the automobile world. He regularly received higher approval ratings than the president.
So I guess in a way he could just decide, I'm going to bring back contradancing.
Well, he was particularly well-suited for a move like that. He was the American dream incarnate, a farm boy who became a self-made motor magnate. People loved him.
So he must have gotten a lot of press.
A lot. And he used that press to push his social dance agenda.
What was that agenda exactly? And why did he revive old-fashioned dancing?
So there are two takes on this. One is that the guy loved music and dance, and he missed the kind of dancing he used to do as a kid, and he saw spreading this dance form as a beneficent, charitable move.
All right, what's the other take?
The other has to do with Ford's demonstrated bigotry. He owned an anti-Semitic newspaper in Detroit and used it to both chronicle the, quote, Jewish menace and to publish a weekly dance column.
So did his dance agenda have an agenda?
Well, possibly more than one. The dancing that was going on in urban cabarets, which, by the way, was unequivocally linked to urban African-American culture, was not to Ford's liking. He dismissed it for making couples dance too closely and contributing to immoral behavior, and he believed that old-fashioned dances like Contra could reorient what he considered to be an out-of-whack value system.
And Ford, if I'm remembering, was all about assimilation, wasn't he? I mean, so this sounds a little bit like he's advocating for a kind of leisure reform, a very Anglo-American approach.
Exactly. Contradancing was this white man's activity, one that Ford figured would encourage gentility and co-working. And he went at it really hard. He established a dance education program. He made his employees join contradances. He helped spread contradance education to Detroit schools.
Not to mention that book of his, which would have helped spread contradance through the U.S. and far beyond those rural communities where it took hold.
And that's exactly why New Hampshire contradance figures still credit Ford with the spread and survival of contradance, though he likely did it for the wrong reasons.
That contradance resurgence in New Hampshire also had a lot to do with the Back to the Lander. So it's kind of hard to imagine Henry Ford getting on board with a bunch of progressive hippies escaping city life.
I think that's the kind of unique thing about Contra. Its pastoral roots might have meant morals and false nostalgia to Henry Ford, but for Back to the Landers, it was part of this self-sufficiency and simplicity. And even today, you've got one generation of Contra dance champions a little flummoxed by what the next generation is doing. The dance is super traditional, but it continues to change. It's dictated by the community rather than by one person.
So what's the contradance scene like today? I mean, any vestiges of that Fordian past?
Not that I could see. So there is a lot of the old guard involved, but these days that just means the hippies who helped the movement to spread again. And then there are a lot of young people, people of different races, kids with tattoos, new musicians trying different things. It's actually a little bit hard to describe. You kind of just have to go.
Which you did.
Which I did.
All right, so my question is, are you going to actually dance?
I am going to dance.
Okay.
I was hoping I could find some sort of way to rig my microphone.
I didn't think it was still a thing. And I didn't think there was still so many people interested in it, which is very lovely to see.
I think it's just really fun. And I love the music, the live music. Yeah, and it's just lots of movement, a lot of people, it's so social.
I would let them know that the social interaction is a big part.
I'm a little bit shy, and usually I'd have to go by myself, so I find a lot of excuses not to.
I also mentioned the eye contact.
I'm going to hang back and watch until I'm either forcibly grabbed and brought onto the dance floor, or I feel confident enough to go on myself.
Because some new dancers will say, I enjoyed the evening, but why was everyone staring at me?
I just tripped on three people in the last one.
We always like to say, bring both left feet.
It's like riding a bike. Yeah, like you just step right in. It's like, oh, yeah, you just do it.
It's not exactly like a bike.
And I like the live music, and I was single at the time, so it was an opportunity to meet, you know, the opposite gender.
Oh, I was with some friends, and we were just going to check it out and try it, and that was it. I met Chris.
You just get to look at your partner, and there is that one-to-one thing.
So it's a great way to get to know people without actually having to talk, or you could talk if you want.
And suddenly, by coming here, we created our community.
There's a huge kind of national contra dance community.
And in a musical context, somebody starts playing a tune, I know that tune, and we immediately have a connection.
They're all young, so that's really nice to see. I haven't seen that before.
So there's a whole new wave. High school, college, especially in Western Mass, it's tons.
Well, I have a friend who lives in Boston, and she and a whole cohort of friends see them dancing all over the place, Facebook pictures all the time. So there are ways to get into this wave.
I moved here in 2011, and I immediately got hooked into the contra dance music scene because I didn't know anybody.
Gordon said, it's fun, and I said, what is it? And all I got was, it's fun, and now I'm here.
So if I wanted to sum it up, I'd say the goal is that people should feel challenged but successful.
I like the idea that I could be great at it.
I'll come back to dance maybe, but to watch definitely, because it is certainly a cool thing to watch, something that's so deep-rooted in America, especially here in the North Country, but just stay alive. It's really nice.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott. In New Hampshire, it can be a balmy 52 and sunny one day and a bomb cyclone of snow and wind the next. It's what you grow to expect as a New Englander, but we still depend on the forecast to make our plans and clean out our grocery stores. So how does that work in a state without a weather service office? Listener Sam Ward submitted an Only in New Hampshire question about our missing meteorologists.
I was just curious to know why the National Weather Service office in Concord closed down. I realize that New Hampshire has the Mount Washington Observatory, but that really leaves the state without a National Weather Service office, and it's the only northern New England state in which that's the case, and I just think that's a real shame.
Producer Justine Paradise decided to track this weather system.
National Weather Service, is John.
I went right to the source for this one. John Jansenius is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Gray, Maine. I caught him just before the holidays a few weeks ago, and just before that big storm that descended on the East Coast right after Christmas.
When are you planning to escape, or are you?
Saturday, probably I'll be going down, so...
Okay. Well, you may want to wait until later in the day.
Yeah.
Till it warms up. Presumably in your area it's going to warm up a little faster than it will over here.
John knows his stuff, thus the timely weather advice. He's been with the National Weather Service for over 40 years and in Maine for more than half that career, which it turns out means a lot to us here in New Hampshire.
In addition to my normal job, we're also what's called the state liaison office for New Hampshire.
So basically we've got some seasoned meteorologists to the east relaying the weather forecast over to New Hampshire. But why not just have our own office? Wouldn't that be more efficient and accurate?
In fact, New Hampshire does have a weather service office. It just happens to be located here in Gray, Maine.
Here's the deal. John says that back in the mid-90s, the National Weather Service reorganized. They had this great new technology, the Doppler radar, and decided to look at the U.S. and Doppler placement in terms of maximizing coverage in an area. This means that some of the bigger states have multiple National Weather Service offices, and some, like New Hampshire, have none.
And in that positioning, we ended up with one here in Gray, Maine. There was also one in Taunton, Massachusetts, and between those two radars, they provided the best coverage for the state of New Hampshire.
It's around this time that New Hampshire's existing National Weather Service office was shut down. But, as it turns out, that didn't really change the way New Hampshire got its weather forecasts.
In the past, what happened is our office, which at that time was located in Portland, actually put out the forecast for the entire state of New Hampshire. And then the Concord office was able to adjust that forecast a little bit for that particular day and for the area right around Concord. But in reality, we've always been putting out the forecast for the state of New Hampshire.
John says that with the reorganization and better technology, they're able to provide accurate forecasts and severe weather warnings, even without local offices to make adjustments. John says closing local offices has meant opening more forecasting offices and hiring more forecasters.
In terms of radar coverage, it's basically the same everywhere across the U.S.
So I took the answers to our question asker, Sam.
Hi there. My name is Sam Ward, and I live outside Toronto, Canada, in a city called Mississauga.
I gave Sam the scoop. I told him about Doppler radar, reorganization, and everything. Does that feel like it answers your question?
No, not really.
What else do you want to know?
Plenty, but never mind. We won't get into that.
Sam said he suspects there's more to the answer, as there almost always is. So we're going to keep an ear to the ground on this one. But in the meantime, I did learn a thing or two about weather files.
It's just something that I've always liked. And if you don't like weather, you just won't understand. But some of us are just fascinated in weather, and it starts at a fairly early age.
Though Sam, who's blind, isn't a Granite Stater himself, his grandparents were from New Hampshire. He says in his days at the Perkins School for the Blind, he would call local weather radio stations to get a sense of things to the north.
I'd take some change and I'd call the WMOU weather phone up in Berlin to find out what the forecast was like there, or the WLNH weather phone in Laconia, or the WKNE weather phone in Keene, or the WBNC weather phone.
Well, maybe it's how I grew up, but I feel like there is a different response when hearing the local forecast via a local station's weather phone, as opposed to reading an app on your phone.
Yeah, it was cool for me to talk to Sam because he had such a strong relationship with his local radio stations and such a strong love for weather. It was something that I learned from, you know?
Producer Justine Paradise, thank you for being our local weather reporter.
You're very welcome.
Word of mouth works because of people like Sam, like you, our listeners. Whether you're wondering what the deal is with that statue in the middle of town, or where your car registration fee goes, or what goes on in that abandoned mountain lodge, we would love to hear from you. Go to nhpr.org and click on the Only in New Hampshire page. You can submit your questions there, or you can send an email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org. We cannot wait to solve those mysteries and explore your state. If you'd like more Word of Mouth, you can check us out at nhpr.org or on Facebook or Twitter at Word of Mouth. Today's episode was produced by Hannah McCarthy, Justine Paradise, and Taylor Quimby. Music by Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, Dudley Laufman, and Sluncha. Extra special thanks to our instigator and guide for today's show, Richard Neville. He wrote the book on contra dance, and it's called A Time to Dance, American Country Dancing from Hornpipes to Hot Hash. And it just came out in a 40th anniversary edition. His 1976 PBS documentary on the subject, Country Corners, is also really worth watching. Thank you also to Shelley Angers, Steve Zakon, Amanda Wiley, Patrice and Chris Aguda-Brown, Perrin Ellsworth-Heller, Tad Dreis, Peter Temple, Sierra Civillo, and Michaela Robbins. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's no parking on the dance floor. And this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.